combined wealth of the 20 richest Americans is now over $1 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Now, to be fair, many of these super rich people are really generous with their wealth. For example, last year, Bill and Melinda Gates donated $4.5 billion to their own foundation. Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg also donated about $1.9 billion, but also to their own foundation. Now, by donating all this money, the super rich are trying to solve problems like poverty, disease, education, family planning, and many other areas, all to make the world a better place, right? Well, Anand Giridharada says the philanthropy of the super rich may actually be a way for them to protect their wealth, status, and privilege. In his new book, he warns us about philanthropy's role in protecting the rich. His new book is called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. It's published by Knopf and is on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations and welcome, but wow, you might have some enemies now.
Yeah, I'm getting invited to considerably less glamorous parties after the last couple weeks.
So how did you get the idea for this book to speak out so publicly?
We live in a very strange age, and I began to notice, like so many Americans, the strangeness. If you just think about right now, we have a president who has a rhetoric of fighting for the common man, but is very clearly enriching himself using their votes. We have in someone like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, someone who's telling us that they're liberating humanity, building tools of empowerment and community, while they allowed our election to be compromised and our, you know, allowing media business models to be gutted across this country. We have this week the 10-year anniversary of Wall Street burning down the global economy. And at the same time, those people on Wall Street now occupy board seats on foundations that fight poverty and claim that they're doing impact investing and claim that they're, you know, helping to reinvent capitalism. And what I started to be puzzled by is how is it that we live in what is clearly, according to the stats you rightly raised, one of the most generous times in history in which rich people seem to be bending over backwards to help in any way they can, but also one of the most predatory moments in American history where the rainwater of the future is harvested almost entirely by and for the few. And what I started to realize was that a lot of this philanthropy and changing the world and social this and social that, all this stuff that rich people do and say, it's often real. It often does help some people. It often does make some difference. But it is also part and parcel of a system of maintaining the world that keeps them on top.
So what you're saying is that it's helping a few people that have, it's very, very obvious, some of the poor, some of the weak, but in reality, it's actually protecting, insulating this wealthy ruling class.
And the evidence for that is very simple. It's called reality. If you walk, just look at some data on America. Since 1979, the bottom half of Americans, about 117 million people, have not gotten a raise on average, right? The average American in that bottom half made $16,000 in 1979. That has risen to a much higher figure of $16,200. Think of what was invented in the last 39 years. The internet, the genetics revolution, what's happened with space, what's happened with electric vehicles, what's happened with the rise of India and China and all the investment opportunities and corporate opportunities that created with trade, with global, everything. The fact that the bottom half of Americans have, on average, basically been passed over by all of that opportunity. And many of your listeners listening to this will know exactly what I'm talking about because they have been passed over by much of that opportunity. Amazing, amazing things have happened to this country since the 1970s. There's no shortage of innovation, no shortage of great companies. But ask yourself, have you benefited from that?
So we know that inequality is increasing. There are more wealthy people around than there have ever been. And it seems like there's this mass wealth. But is it the case that people are poor or they're just, their wealth is just not growing?
Well, there's both. You have people who are essentially stuck where they are, stuck in the mud, while all this promise, you know, froths all around them. And that's what I, you know, inequality is one word, but it often makes people's eyes glaze over. I like to think about it as, you know, who owns the future. When the future rains on us, who gets the rainwater? And what you have happening is some people just, you know, get a little bit of that rainwater. So yeah, their lives get a little bit better. But you have a lot of people over the last 30, 40 years who have been dislocated by innovation and change and who are actually worse off. You know, if you had a steady, you know, how often you get in a cab or an Uber and that was someone who was a business owner 20 years ago.
I got to tell you a story. I was in an Uber, one of these Uber pools, and I was chatting with the driver, sat in the front seat, and he was telling me he had been in real estate and he had done all this stuff, and we were getting along, and then he begins to tell me that he had a buddy who was going to receive some chest from one of these doorman buildings. So he goes up to the apartment and he says, I felt sick to my stomach. I don't know if I had the runs or whatever, and I just had to get out of there immediately. And then he tells me, he says, when I got out, and I wanted to know, why did you get so sick in this apartment? He says, because I realized how poor I am and that I'm never going to have that degree of wealth. And so I see that every day. We all see that. And this is what you speak to when you look at these folks.
What I found is that the very rich and powerful people who are, I want to stress, they are doing real giving. This is not fake. They are giving their money away in many cases. They are doing corporate CSR projects. They are, you know, giving to some shelter. But here's what they're not doing. When rich people move into the space of social change, when they start to get board seats on organizations doing that change, when they actually start to colonize the discourse around change, when they start to give TED Talks and be on radio shows and write books about what they think change is, they redefine change. And when rich people redefine change, they tend to redefine it in a particular way. They defang change. They redefine change in a way that is unthreatening to rich people. And the form that takes is on each issue where we could imagine real transformational change in American life, change that most of your listeners would agree they need, the rich try to proffer a slightly different, easier, lighter, kinder, gentler change that would be easier on rich people. So to take an example, I bet many of your listeners would love to have this society be more supportive of women's empowerment. And we all know from many countries in Europe, for example, that the way you actually empower women to play their multiple roles and to be in the workforce and be family people, etc., is you have social policy. You actually give people maternity leave. You actually give people healthcare. You actually give people childcare tax credits, those kinds of things. But what's the problem with that? Very expensive for rich people. The richer you are, the more you're going to pay for women to have those kind of social policies. So what do? Do they tell women, you know, sorry, you're out of luck? No, because then women would come for them. So what do? They have to proffer something that seems like it's real change, but it's fake change. So they tell women, lean in. Raise your hand more. That's the problem. You're not raising your hand enough. You just, you know, you just talk more in meetings. Have mentorship circles. What all that kind of advice that is so abundant around us, this advice to women to basically make sexism their problem. Who's benefiting from that? The people who would have to pay if we actually solve the problem structurally. And we could talk about how that same dynamic, real change and then the fake change counteroffer, happens on healthcare, how it happens on taxes. We say, okay, you know, let's do Kiva or microloans to help poor people. Okay, I mean, nothing wrong with it. But you know what would be real change on that issue? Actually, like, taxing inheritances more. Actually taxing global capital that flows around and does this double Dutch with an Irish sandwich pirouette tax maneuver so rich people don't pay their fair share of taxes.
A bunch of people in New York just gasped when you said that.
Well, a bunch of people who live in New York in reality, but who pretend to live in Florida to avoid a relatively minor New York. I mean, I can't tell you how often in this world that I reported on for the last few years, you find New Yorkers who fake live in Florida. And what I would just say to them is, why are you doing this? You want to be part of this city. You want to be part of this community. You love these buildings. You love the people you have dinner parties with here. You love the organization you work for here that you feel maybe couldn't be elsewhere. So you want all the benefits of this society, which frankly is an expensive thing to make.
But you don't want to pay for it.
But you don't want to pay that minor surtax on like your million-dollar income.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Anand Giridharadas. He's talking about his best-selling book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Now, Anand, you speak about your time at the Aspen Institute and how that was the beginning of this book, where you are in front of all these rich and powerful people, and you take a stance and you actually tell them about themselves. You essentially say, hey, you're the bad guy.
I was, in 2011, I was invited into this benevolent secret society called the Henry Crown Fellowship of the Aspen Institute. And there are many of these around the world. Davos has its own fellowships. You know, there's a lot of these kind of fellowships that are essentially about young leaders and kind of taking young leaders and trying to groom them to make a bigger difference. Now, this particular fellowship was a weird fit for me. It was mostly business people and entrepreneurs who were kind of being groomed to play this larger societal role.
But hold on, you know, in the defense, you're an Ivy League educated person, best-selling books.
But I'm not a business person, right? Okay. So I was an unusual, they had like 21 people, you know, 18 would be business people, and then they'd let in a couple others for like spice and entertainment. So I was the spice and entertainment, you know, the Indian guys and inevitably the spice. And so I was in this group, but it was not quite the norm for me, frankly. It was a lot of operating business people, people with companies, very eye-opening for me. And we bonded as a group, and it was a really great experience interpersonally. But as I got into this world of these rich and powerful people coming to these conclaves and talking about making the world better, it started to seem to me that what we were in fact doing when we came together was the opposite of what it seemed. Because our gatherings were sponsored by Goldman Sachs and Monsanto and Pepsi, which don't necessarily seem to be making the world a better place. We had seminar discussions about making the world a better place in the Koch seminar building funded by one of the Koch brothers. And it started to seem to me that when folks with immense wealth and privilege come together and have this engage in this rhetoric of changing the world and do some projects that change the world, what often happens also is the coordination of silence.
The coordination of silence. So yes. You're saying that these circles where folks have the power, have the resources to make things happen, that they're only making some things happen so that they don't hurt themselves.
Correct. And I think what a lot of injustice and cruelty is prosecuted through silence. We often imagine that it's done through, you know, horrible, you know, assertive deeds. But what I started to witness was these were very good people. These were decent, kind people, family people, people who I think are sincere generally in wanting to make the world better. Not always, but in general. That was my experience. But injustice prosecuted by silence. We would come together and we'd have these conversations. And what would be more notable than what we talked about would be what we learned, what we were socialized to not talk about in those spaces.
You got to give me specifics. What were you told not to talk about that's hurting us?
In those spaces, everyone talks about rich people should do more good. You know what they don't talk about? Rich people should do less harm. In those spaces, everyone talks about rich people should give more. You know what they don't talk about? Rich people should take less. In all of those spaces, we talk about, you know, the spoils of capitalism, the extra fruit that it bears, should be shared with people left behind by it. What you can't talk about in those spaces is why is capitalism systematically, again and again, the way we practice it, leaving so many people out predictably, reliably, foreseeably. And so perhaps because I am a writer and I focus on language and I think a lot about what is said and what is not said, the silences became blaring to me. I started to hear them more loudly than what we were saying. And yes, one day I was asked to give a speech to the group, and I am of the view personally that whole point of a society keeping writers around is to say things people don't want to hear. I decided to use the opportunity to give a speech to surprise the people who I was speaking to, which included many millionaires and billionaires and lots of you know, influential people in corporate America and these folks that I'd done this fellowship with and others. And I decided to tell them what I thought and tell them that I thought we lived within this Aspen consensus, as I called it, in which we thought we were doing good, but in which we were also upholding the very problems we were helping to cause and sustain, the very problems we were then turning around and claiming to be solving.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and you're listening to Anand Giridharadas talk about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Saving the World. Mm-hmm. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and we're speaking with Anand Giridharadas about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Now, Anand, you lay down a pretty clear argument, and you talk about the way that we are conditioned to think about the whole win-win, that it always has to be a win-win, but you argue sometimes rich people have to lose.
If you think about it, I mean, what sounds better than win-win? I mean, what a lovely concept. That's not just one victory, but two. And I think the win-win is one of the most successful and dangerous ideas of our modern culture. We hear it all the time. You hear it in business, you hear it on TV. I mean, now that I will say this, you will notice this phrase, your listeners will notice it in ads, they'll see it on the backs of trucks. Like, this phrase is everywhere in our culture. And what it means in theory is we can all win together, no sacrifice. You know, you can help someone and you can also win yourself. And this is the idea behind tote bags that change the world. This is the idea when Morgan Stanley says, you know, let's raise the capital that changes the world. Like, the bank can prosper and we can make the world a better place. The win-win is behind Mark Zuckerberg, you know, building one of the most ruthless monopolies in the history of this country while also claiming to be empowering mankind and, you know, compromising our election. This is the spirit behind the idea of the people who caused the financial crisis and caused many, many people in this city and around this country to have their homes foreclosed on can turn around and build a charter school for the children of the people who lost their homes.
But what would you have them do? You want people to lose? How do we get this?
Here's the problem with win-win. The problem with win-win is that it supposes that rich people must receive a kickback from social change, that power must be done in ways that is all, that power must be changed in ways that are beneficial to the powerful. It doesn't work. And so there are many real win-wins in life. You know, you want a cup of coffee and Starbucks is selling it. That's a real win-win. You know, you give them your money, you get your coffee. There's plenty of win-wins in life. But social change is often not a win-win. And part of what's happened is the consumer logic of the win-win has infected the domain of social change, which is fundamentally about power changing hands. And so what I believe needs to happen is to have the kind of real change that actually people who are Republican and Democrat seem to agree we need, because there's a very widespread feeling in this country that we need transformational change, that the system feels rigged to people. To get that kind of real change, it's going to require something deeper than a win-win. It's going to require the common good winning, and in many cases, elites having to sacrifice.
Do you see a world where that's even possible, where they're going to allow themselves? Why wouldn't they defend themselves?
Oh, they will defend themselves, but the public has the numbers. It just has to be willing to use it. The problem is we have outsourced the changing of the world to billionaires. Here's the reality. A lot of what I write about in this book, I spent time in this world. I spent time with people who are elites attempting to make change while also holding on to their privilege.
You were flying in private jets, swimming pools with billionaires.
All of it. I went on a cruise ship with 3,000 entrepreneurs so your listeners wouldn't have to. And what I found is that many, many good people in this world are unwilling and unable to surrender voluntarily their power and privilege for the common good. And in some ways, that's normal. That's what we should expect. But what that does mean is that we, as the public, should not be shy about acting through our democracy to form the common good for ourselves. We should not be outsourcing the job of making the world. We shouldn't be saying, okay, Zuckerberg can take on fix the schools and healthcare, and Elon Musk's going to handle space, and this person's going to do this, and this person's going to do that. We actually need to go back to the idea in this country of when you see a problem, asking yourself, what is a public, democratic, universal, and institutional fix for that problem? And we have forgotten how to do that. And we need to resume that heritage.
You speak about the privatization of all this social change. Charities are a huge part of the American economy. By some estimates, more than 5% of the U.S. GDP is in the hands of nonprofits. You're saying that that whole structure is actually designed to help a few, but really protect the wealthy.
Do your listeners know that they pay, because we give a charitable tax deduction, including the very wealthy people who make multi-billion dollar donations, that's tax money that we could be collecting from those people that we don't. Are your listeners aware that they work longer hours every year and they pay higher taxes every year so we can fund billionaires to make charitable donations? Are they aware of that?
A lot of people are aware of the tax code, but you're suggesting that we should just eliminate those deductions?
No.
What are you?
Well, I actually think. Sorry, I think eliminating the deduction is something we should consider. I'm not sure what that it's a complex policy question. I do think a more subtle idea would be, we should give the deduction depending on how public spirited your donation is. Okay, if you are giving to a public library, okay, now let's play a couple scenarios. If you're putting your name on it, I view that as a purchase. I don't view that as a donation. If you're putting your name on it, you're getting something in exchange. For why should the government subsidize you? If you're not putting your name on it, maybe that's a little more favorable. If in giving to that library, you insist on controlling how the money is spent, you're now the chairman of the board of that library, you decide what it goes to, you decide what programs they do. Again, you're purchasing something. You're purchasing power. You're trading your money for power. I don't think the government should subsidize you. If, on the other hand, you're willing to have your donation submit to public authorities and have the public authorities decide what to do, maybe we look upon that more favorably. I think a more interesting and creative idea would be to actually condition the charitable tax deduction based on how public-spirited your donation is and how much you actually submit and empower public authority to make the decisions that are properly its.
Some people are listening to you and they're thinking what you're saying is really dangerous. Given the current political environment, we see the ascension of Trump, someone who is extraordinarily wealthy, but supported by folks who make far less. Far, far less. What do you say to people who will tell you what you're saying is dangerous? That you are fueling a lot of unrest right now?
I just purely disagree. I mean, I have more contempt for Donald Trump than I think is reasonably healthy. And what I don't want and what I see happening is Donald Trump, there's a temptation to think that the story of Donald Trump began in 2015. But Donald Trump was able to become president of this extraordinary country. Such a low man was able to capture the highest office in such a great land only because so much of this society was broken, because so many people had been unheard. And I don't just mean the people who voted for him. There are a lot of people unheard on the left who weren't as enthusiastic and trusting in their party as they might have been. And I don't think you get a Donald Trump without a large number of people in this country rightfully being convinced that the ruling class of this country, left, right, center, corporate, and otherwise, doesn't really care about them, makes decisions for their own reasons, pays lip service to ordinary people, and doesn't know them, isn't part of them, and frankly, doesn't care what happens to them. And we have watched as the American dream has vanished from the majority of Americans' lives. Today, you have a 50-50 chance of out-earning your parents in this country. It used to be 90%. And then we're shocked that we have an angry politics. We're shocked that a demagogue is in the White House. What I want something deeper personally than the defeat of Donald Trump. I want the defeat of Donald Trump, however it happens, to mark the end of a long era of fake change and the spark of an age of reform in this country.
Fake change. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Anand Giridharadas talking about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of, wow, it's sort of amazing. You know, this, the elite charade of changing the world. We're talking about rich folks, super rich actually, who are using charities and situations to actually benefit themselves, even though there are a lot of people who benefit from the generosity of the rich folks in New York City and around the world. You are saying that that generosity follows a couple of key rules. One, it always has to be win-win. I'm only going to give you if my cup keeps flowing over. And two, you can't do anything that threatens me. Is that generally the case?
We can't change the system. And one of the things I say in this book, we live in New York in a very generous city. I mean, how many galas or galas or however you pronounce that word, how many are there in this city, right? But half our city lives under poverty or nearly above it, right? So is generosity working for New York? Is generosity the panacea that people claim it is? What are all those galas doing for New Yorkers. The reality is generosity is not a substitute for justice. And it's been marketed to us as a substitute for justice. But generosity and justice are not the same thing.
In your book, and I read it, and I forget exactly who you quote, but you make the case that back in America's history, some of the wickedest slave owners were the kindest, because they convinced you that the system was okay because they were kind to you, even though they were slave masters. You see parallels with today?
You know, it's an Oscar Wilde quote, and when I read it, you know, that has some, you know, as you say, said, you know, the worst slave owners were the kindest because they prevented the reality of the institution from being seen for what it was. When I first read that, I thought, I mean, that's preposterous. How can the nicest ones be the worst ones? And I still struggle with that quote, but I have slowly come to see the power of it. And I do think it's deeply parallel today. The people I'm writing about are doing good things, are doing good works, are trying to help, are saving lives in many cases, are bringing opportunity to places. They are making people's lives better at the margin. So what could be wrong with that? What could be wrong with that is if their good works are abetting or an accomplice to causing greater harm. If those good works are actually part of a system that upholds the harm doing.
You call that market world.
And that's market world. And market world is, as I define it in the book, a complex of people and institutions that aspire to do well by doing good, that aspire for these win-wins, that aspire to be able to make a killing and make a difference, that aspire to be able to change the world while also having their world not change. And it is people like the Sackler family, who is the family that invented, through their company, Purdue Pharma, the major drug behind the opioid crisis. 200,000 Americans have now died as part of that extended crisis. Think about that for a second. 200,000 Americans. Those are genocide numbers.
So what do you think they owe us, that family?
So what would justice be in that case? I think it would involve... So the company did have a criminal investigation against it, and it settled, and it admitted to fraud and other malfeasance. I don't think anything's happened to the family. I don't think even any executives went to jail from that company. And I think one of the reasons there hasn't been justice in that case, but it's only one out of many cases you and I could talk about, is the Sacklers were also very generous philanthropists through that same period. This city, Washington, D.C., every city in this country probably, every major city has some kind of Sackler philanthropic contribution.
Do I understand your view correctly? So you are suggesting because they owned the company that created these drugs and so many Americans died because of this, you likened the word you use was genocide, that...
And other drugs in the opioid crisis. It wasn't only this drug, but theirs was the main one.
But that this family should face criminal charges, that they should be made to pay because they're the ones who made the money off of these drugs that caused countless deaths in the USA.
And I don't know the facts of who knew what. I mean, you have to have a criminal investigation, and I don't know whether it should be executives that faced that justice or family members. I don't know what family members knew, but you'd have to do that proper. But the fact that you can have that many people die in a crisis that we all now agree is a national emergency, in part because who is, you know, doing those drugs versus who does other drugs and doesn't qualify as an emergency, but that's a whole other show.
But you're saying that because white folks were the ones who were dying principally.
We all agree that's an emergency instead of a, you know, epidemic. And what just is amazing to me is that we let this happen to us and we allow ourselves to be bought for not that much money. I mean, this family made billions of dollars. Recently, in one of the recent years, they were the Forbes, you know, new family that kind of made the most new money in a certain period. Most of that money came from this drug. And today, their descendants, you know, are on the boards at the museum. The Brooklyn Museum has a, like, Sackler Center. You know, artists take the patronage. We all enjoy the museums. And I think what we all have to consider is, what is our relationship to that kind of art when it is the art of blood money?
the art of blood money. So Anand, you make the case that, you know, we're selling ourselves for not much money. And by that, you're saying that the charity is the price that they are paying. That's how they're buying us cheap. Do I understand that correctly? What are we supposed to do?
I'll tell you, there's what I call the M&B law. Most of the harm done to the society is of the B in billions. You earn billions doing the harm. And then most of that, the charity that you do to change your reputation and get some nice stories in the newspapers with an M, it's in the millions. So that's usually a pretty good deal. You know, you profit from the mortgage crisis. That's usually in the billions. A lot of people lose their homes. Then you donate to, you know, a program to help women or to a shelter, and that's usually in the millions. So these companies are able to essentially build a winners-take-all economy and winners-take-all society in which they're the only ones who can win because of how they organize it. And then they, you know, sprinkle a little fairy dust of charity on the people who are left out. And it's not that it doesn't help those people, and it's not that it's not kind, but it's less kind than it looks when you are also part and parcel of the operation to deprive those people of opportunity in the first place.
You speak about going to these elite circles where they made some pretty strange juxtapositions. You attended a seminar where Plato and Gandhi were lumped together with former GE CEO Jack Welch.
I know. That should have been the first sign. I mean, yeah, when I was in this Aspen program and we had these readings, and you got to read, you know, great thinkers throughout history as part of your journey of thinking about how you want to play a bigger role and how you want to solve social problems. And so there was the Gandhi and there was the Plato and there was, you know, other great readings. And then, you know, you turn the page and it's like Jack Welch. And you think, huh. But that's what's interesting is, you know, I sat not long ago next to a French journalist at an event. She said, you know what the difference between America and other countries is? You know, in America, business is not just your economy, it's your culture. And I think in this country, part of what has happened, particularly in the last generation, is that we've let business people be more than business people. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, buy for a dollar and sell for two, as they say on the wire. That's business. That's fine. Great. Good luck. Enjoy. But when business people become thinkers, when they become philosophers, I mean, look at an airport bookstore, right? We don't just let these people buy and sell. We turn them into our gurus. And what that has done, it has allowed them to, given them a platform to push their vision of change on us and to make us forget what real change looks like.
So that they win at the same time that they're trying to help.
Some years ago, there was a parody account called GS Elevator, Goldman Sachs Elevator, that purported to say things overheard in the elevator. And that account provided the best definition of win-win that I've ever heard. A win-win is when I beat you twice.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Duarte Giraldino, and I've been speaking with Anand Giridhar about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Saving the World.